Justin Filtner and John Weisberger were going to be a guest on this program toward the end of last year, 2018. As a matter of fact, there was a plan that I would meet John and Justin both to talk about their brand new album, Watch It Burn, on Robust Records, while we were all to be in Raleigh, North Carolina together. And Justin couldn't be there. We caught up finally toward the end of the year, right before the holidays, with a conference call with John and Justin to talk about songwriters coming together and create great music on this Watch It Burn album. Justin is ill. He's currently under treatment for cancer. As a matter of fact, there's a GoFundMe page that is connected to the Facebook site that you would go to find Steve Martin's Unreal Bluegrass. And there's a GoFundMe there for his next phase of treatment. We talked about music. You're going to hear that in the second hour. Two great songwriters talking about the craft, the art of songwriting. This will be a nice 40-minute conversation with the both of them as we explore what it is for artists who write songs to get together and write great songs like on this album, and the contributions of both. Really fascinating talk. Thanks so much for tuning in. I am very happy to welcome, for the first time, Justin Filtner and John Weisberger back to Unreal Bluegrass. So how are you both of you doing today?
Great. Thanks for having us.
Doing well. Thanks, Steve.
It's good
to be back.
Well, it is good to be back, John. It was April 2013, so I think we've let enough grass grow between our feet to where we can where we can maybe talk again. I don't know what happened then, but we've not, other than IBMA meetings, we haven't had a conversation on the air before since then. So, I don't know.
We're overdue.
First of all, congratulations on I absolutely love Watch It Burn. I've been listening to it in anticipation. I've been playing the songs off and on, but it's a great collection of songs. I know there's a lot of backstory between the both of you as to how you began writing together, and I want to cover that as it comes up. And either one of you feel free to jump in. It isn't really my intent to force the questions. I just kind of want to talk about the album. But I thought I would start with this first. You're a tremendous banjo player, and I kind of pay attention to those things.
Thank you.
And your style is just, there's a lot of real crisp stuff and some of this waltz stuff that you do later on in the album. But what was your inspiration to be playing a banjo?
Oh, well, I was, 6 years old, and I saw a banjo on TV, and I was like, I want to do that. And my parents were like, yeah, okay, sure. If you still want to play banjo a year from now, we'll get you a banjo. And so a year later, I was still on about it. So they got me a banjo, and I got started and just like learning tab and just kind of came into bluegrass backwards because I decided to play five-string banjo and didn't really like know, like my parents weren't really plugged into bluegrass at all or anything. So I kind of came into it like kind of backwards. But the main inspirations for me have always been like, I play an archtop, and so like Ralph Tammy is a big inspiration. You can hear some of that on the record. Don Reno, again, there's some pretty weird turnarounds I do on a couple of tracks that you can tell are Don Reno inspired. And basically, at this point, I've gotten to a point where I just want to play whatever comes out of me. I'm not really practicing solos or setting up what I'm going to play like here or there. I basically don't play the same thing twice. I just kind of want the moment to create itself, and that's reflected a lot in this record, and John can attest to that, I'm sure.
Go ahead, John.
No, I was going to say that's certainly true. I'm glad that you picked up on Justin's banjo playing, because I think it's one of the real strengths of the album and of the work we've done together. Justin also played on a couple of numbers on the Roland White album that I produced earlier this year. And I love his banjo playing because, as you say, it's so distinctive. There are a lot of great banjo players around, but there are also a lot of banjo players who tend to play pretty much in the same groove. And sometimes it's hard to tell one from another. But Justin's really easy to pick out because the word I like is idiosyncratic.
That's a good one. That's a good word.
I'll take it.
I also think, Justin, your playing is, I'm trying to think quickly off the top of my head, an analogous player, let's say in jazz versus bluegrass, but your notes, you're not trying to fill every space. Now, there's a lot of different quotes from jazz musicians about it's as important as what you don't play as what you do play. But I think you're playing is very distinct and separate, and maybe that's what attracts me to it, because it's so clean and so easy to separate the notes and what I hear and what I'm listening to.
Oh, I really appreciate that careful listening that you put into it, because that's something that I specifically choose to do, because it makes the music easier for people to digest, right? It's easier, it's much more kind of like a digestible little package all in one. And so it's something that you don't hear feedback on that specific choice that I'm making to like kind of step back and be a little more reserved musically, because generally it's not something you notice. Like, typically with banjo, you notice when it's too much, right?
Right, that's right.
Banjo isn't an instrument where you typically are noticing it when it's not as present. So I really appreciate that. You picked up on that nuance.
Well, good. And here, let me tell you this before we get off of the banjo issue. The player that I always thought, not an archtop player, and by the way, for the listeners, an archtop, by the nature of its construction, is going to be, I would describe it as a little bit of a brighter sound. And if you do think of Ralph and some of the Reno stuff, it's brighter because the way the physics works on the way the tone bell, the tone ring is made. But I also think this, Bill Emerson is one of my favorite players. And Bill just nails the notes that he plays, and it sounds like, you know, oh, I can do that, but it's so perfect, and he's so selective in the notes that he's playing to play the melody. And I would think not an archtop player at all, but your playing makes me think of that as far as the selection process.
Yeah, that's a pretty good comparison, I think, because Bill, even though it demonstrates itself, like it manifests itself differently in our playing, like that those specific choices we're making to be a little, to leave space or be more pointed about the notes we're playing, like he comes across in his playing as that really like relaxed sort of like laid back melodic lilt, right?
Yeah. It's
kind of like a bounce to everything he plays.
And
I love that. I love that you can hear that he's not driving through absolutely everything. He's like letting the banjo bounce back and forth. I love that so much about his playing.
Well, you're a very strong player. I read a little bit about your history. I know you've been playing off and on, seriously. Well, I say mostly on for what, 6-7 years? Or either one of you, tell me about the history connection between you. I've read a little bit about it, but rather than what I've read, when you started writing together, and then kind of what led to the culmination of this collection of tunes, which is called Watch It Burn on Robust Records. Can somebody, both of you, can chime
sure.
in on that?
Sure. Yeah. I'll start. I remember Justin was part of a band of young musicians that Roland White put together for a Bill Monroe Appreciation Night one year. I guess 2011. I think that's right. And we conversed some then and talked about writing together, and I'm always happy to write with folks, and I really enjoyed Justin's playing there. So we started writing together, and we've just been doing that ever since, not really with the thought of a project of ours in mind, but just, you know, when you're a songwriter, you write songs, and then you look for people to record them. And as time went by, you know, I was pitching some of these songs that he and I had written to other folks, but we hadn't gotten any nibbles yet, and maybe Justin can tell us. We wound up doing a show together at the Station Inn with a great band that plays on half the album, and then decided to turn that into a record.
Yeah, it just, the whole process kind of like happened so organically. It kind of like built itself in reverse. Because like I remember when I met John, and when the first songwriting session that we like booked, I was like going into it because I had specifically been like, hey, I would love for some songwriting tips, like, you know, like for you to like look at some of my songs and like give me some tips on songwriting. And I showed up and it was just like, let's write a song. And I was like, oh, okay, great. There's no sort of like audition process here. You just, all right, great. So, and the first song, it just turned out that's the first song we ever wrote together was Lady Slippers, that's on the record.
Right, yeah.
And it's one of my favorites. It's like, it must have just been first timer's luck, I guess. It was my first co-write in Nashville. It was might have been my first co-write ever, like really and truly.
I didn't know that.
Well, I'm trying to think if I ever...
See what you learn. See what you learn on this program.
On Unreal Bluegrass.
That's
exactly
right. That's right.
Like, and if you listen to that song, it does not sound like a green song at all. And like, I think that John and I just immediately had this really great rapport, able to like pick song ideas that we could write to be true to the song and not necessarily write it to be true to just like bluegrass as a genre or a certain like pitch we were trying to make. We were just writing songs because we had the ideas, not because we had a specific like purpose for them. So then when we get to the point of having an album's worth of songs, it was like, oh hey, we have an album's worth of songs that are kind of our unique songwriting voice, even though they're pretty diverse and kind of in the ground they cover musically and thematically. But it's just it all kind of just fell into place, especially I mean with John as an instigator. He's really good at this, like taking me from being like somebody who was like, hey, I'd love a songwriting tip, to just making it a songwriting thing. Like, he's really good at putting people together, putting pieces together, and like thinking about like how music can be made kind of for the music's sake and not, you know, necessarily for like any sort of commercial gain. It just happens so like organically and perfectly, I think.
You mentioned Ladies Slippers, apostrophe S. Yes, the singer is trying to find a certain flower.
Yes.
Right, for a purpose of trying one more time is the way I would paraphrase what's going on. Which of you know about this flower because of where it's grown? This is the things that I think about. Who thought about this particular flower?
That would be Justin.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's got my fingerprints all over it. I tend to, I'm an avid bird watcher and kind of a hobby naturalist.
I thought you were called birders. I thought they didn't like being called bird watchers.
Well, everybody uses their preferred terminology.
Right. I met with a guy once in a totally different setting, you're a bird watcher. He's a birder. So I was kind of corrected on that. I'm not trying to correct you, but I adopted birder.
I probably was, you know, thinking like, I would say bird watcher so that it would be a little easier to literally understand.
Okay.
If somebody heard this on the radio, birder.
Okay.
It sometimes flies over their heads,
okay.
As it were.
Yeah.
But yeah, so just by nature of like being outdoors all the time, I'm always coming up with these like kind of obscure, like nature-based song ideas that because they're kind of obscure, like require exposition. So like, it's like we want people to know, like, Lady Slippers is a flower that grows in a specific place.
Right.
It's kind of hard to find, like, and it's kind of funny how that it still comes across pretty easily as a traditional bluegrass song, despite me coming from the, like, most, like, specific nerdy angle into that songwriting session.
You have a lot of up-tempo tunes, which I think works really well. Ladies Slippers, I have to remember the S, the apostrophe S.
Exactly.
It's kind of a medium, it's a medium tempo, but you start off right away with Watch It Burn, which is pretty upbeat as far as the tempo. And the song, it's not just, if you look at the title, of course, that's the title cut for the album, you would think that maybe Watch It Burn is something other than the way I listen to the song. It's a letting go. The fire is actually kind of a cleansing. Am I reading
exactly
that right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Well,
totally. Yeah, and you know, and this, I mean, you, one of the things that kind of moved this project forward, and that we feel really good about is that it's you know, there's one or two, you know, there's the ballad, This Isn't How I Wanted to Come Home.
Right.
But it mostly is up-tempo bluegrass.
Yeah, it is.
With, you know, three or four chords. So it's a very, it's funny because it's not, it's hard for me to call it a traditional bluegrass album, but it's not anything but bluegrass. It's not any kind of hyphenated bluegrass.
I agree with you.
A modern take on bluegrass or an edgy bluegrass album. It's right down the middle of the pike from our point of view.
I agree with you.
And one of the things that I appreciate in writing with Justin is, he's enough of a bluegrass fanatic that you know, we can talk about, oh, this is going to be this song. I can see this song kind of having a Don Reno feel to it, or something like that, and he's right with me, and you know, so we really work together well in writing bluegrass songs that are bluegrass songs, but that maybe have a little bit of a different content or a different context than your typical bluegrass mainstream.
I agree with you. It's bluegrass. I have no, you know, I will stand up in front of an audience and say, if you're trying to decide, which I hate those discussions, John, as you know, I would say this is clearly in the bluegrass, easily identifiable. Let me ask you this. My favorite phrase in that, and Justin, anyone can talk about this, smoke is my disguise. Now, I've not heard that phrase before. And that's when you really, if you really listen to the lyrics, smoke is my disguise. There's more than going on than just even the symbolic fire. It really is a letting go, and I said cleansing, but I could use any number of terms. But the term smoke is my disguise. It's like as the fire is going, it's like there's a magician. The trick has already happened, and now the smoke is occurring. But I'm already finished with what I'm doing.
Man, you have your finger on the pulse of this record, Steve. I've got to say, no, that's like uncanny. That line I remember. Specifically coming from me because of it being kind of clunky and like in the way it's sung, you know, the smoke is my disguise. Like mm-hmm. it's not the smoothest line in that song, but it was really kind of like just the song for me. The cleansing is of all of these regrets, right? And
right.
Like the house, like what remains but shame, you know that. And so like the idea that like. Not only was he burning it down, but the speaker is also creating a smoke screen for himself, you know, for the regret and the shame. Like, that's exactly what that line was coming from.
It's great. I mean, it's a great song, and that's a really, of course, it's the first one. It's upbeat. Let me ask you this, both of you, who's got the connection with the Winsboro, the Granite Mines?
Oh, that would be me.
Okay. Tell me about that, because I'll tell you a quick story about it when you're finished about that song. And go ahead.
I love that it hasn't happened often. It's maybe just once or twice now, maybe three times, that song is connected with somebody who's, like, connected to Fairfield County, South Carolina, where there's this town called Winsboro, and the center of the town's economy for decades was this granite quarry where they cut blue granite. It's called Winsboro Blue, and the slogan was "The Silk of the Trade," and it's a really cool little area. The quarry is abandoned now and just sits empty, but every house within miles of this quarry is built out of the blue granite, and all of their their fencing, their walls around their yards and fencing is made out of the blue granite. And the blue granite is everywhere, and so I came up with this idea like. Obviously, if it's called Winsboro Blue, it's got to be a bluegrass song. And what are bluegrass songs about? They're about the blues. And so it just happened. It was a bluegrass song waiting to happen.
That was the first song from the album that I played when I first started playing it. And you know, eventually building up to where we could talk about this this was weeks ago, obviously, if not a month. I've been to Winsboro, and I've been to the Granite. I've been to where they cut the granite.
No kidding.
No.
That's incredible. Yeah.
I have a friend that lives in Winsboro. And years ago, we visited when we had, like, more time than we thought because, you know, once we were at his house for a while, it's like, well, now what are we going to do? And it's like, well, let's go to the granite mine. So there was a guy there, just happened to be there, and he showed us how they cut it because it was closed then. So he showed us how, you know, you put the things in, you split it, and how you move them up the rock and everything. And as soon as I heard that song, I thought, well, I think I know exactly what this is about because I stood there.
That's incredible. That's awesome. Yeah, my uncle owns property in Fairfield County, and so he was the one who, like, drove me around there. And he actually had a bunch of paving stones, a little cubic, like, cobblestones that he got from up there, and he gave me one of them, so it was like a paperweight. It's like right here on the shelf.
Right? Oh, nice, cool.
It's a little chunk of Winsboro blue granite.
My friend was the county extension agent many, many years ago.
That's so cool.
And it's just like,
again, you really have your finger on the pulse of this record.
I think I've done all that I can. I think the rest of them are just going to be songs. Those are the ones I picked out first because I knew something how to talk about them. But that one, I knew exactly what it was, and that was the first tune that I played from
really,
that one.
Like, ultra-specific for something that is so specific.
It is. Tell me a little bit more about your collaborative efforts, and we'll get back into some of the songs. We don't need to talk about every song, but the way you write, and I read something about the eclipse had some sort of triggering factor. And I don't normally read, you know, notes to talk about, but I read that and I thought I need to get in this a little bit more because I don't understand it.
Well, so, this is the eclipse is almost literally responsible for this record being made. Justin and I had back in the spring of 2017, we were down at the Station Inn chatting, and Justin plays banjo sometimes with the Roland White Band.
Yeah.
And I always enjoy playing with him as well as writing with him. And I finally said, well, let's you and me book a show as us at the Station Inn, and that way we'll get to play together. And so we did, and we got Casey Campbell and Karina Rose Longston and Amanda Fields to be the band. And
all of those are on this album, right?
And they're all on the mm-hmm. album, exactly. They're on about half the album. Mm-hmm. I sort of thought, well, okay, well, we'll do a bunch of good old bluegrass songs. Because that's what you do when you throw together a band to go play the Station Inn. But everybody was interested in doing originals. And so we wound up putting together this show of all the songs that Justin and I had written, plus a couple of Karina had written, plus a couple of Amanda had written, plus a couple that were on Casey Campbell's Mandolin Duets album.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned out to be the show. And, I mean, literally the next day I flew off to San Diego to play a festival out there and came back. Justin was the guy who pointed out to me that the eclipse was basically happening right in my backyard, center line of the eclipse passed literally through my backyard. And so we wound up, my wife and I wound up having a little kind of eclipse watching party. And we were talking after the eclipse was over.
I'm laughing, John, because Justin had to tell you that the eclipse was going to be in your backyard.
I was like, hey, this is going to be close to Nashville. I'm just going to zoom in on the center line of like what I think is the closest point to Nashville and see where it is. And it just, as I zoomed in, I was just like, oh, John? I'm zooming in on John's house.
That's funny.
It's John's house.
Exactly. So Melody Walker from Front Country was up here to check out the eclipse, and she asked how the show went. And Justin and I were talking to her, oh, it went great. You know, we did all these original songs. It's like we have an album's worth of songs together. And we kind of looked at each other, and that's when the light bulb went off that we had the material to do a record, basically. And yeah. So, you know, if it hadn't have been for the eclipse, I don't know how long it would have taken for us to realize that.
Look at that. This is the songwriter speed. You're in an eclipse and the light bulb goes off. Come on.
Exactly. No, when we, like, actually, we wrote that bio copy that you're referencing.
I did.
Like,
I saw that, yeah.
With the eclipse in it. Actually, John and I both are also not just songwriters, but also music writers, and have written countless bios among us and articles and et cetera, et cetera. So we actually traded off. He wrote a paragraph. I wrote a paragraph of our bio. We batted that back and forth, and the eclipse through line happened once again organically. It was perfect.
We talked a little bit about some of the people on the album. You've got Molly Tuttle. Tim O'Brien sings. If I Were a Praying Man? Is that
yes.
You know, anytime you can get Tim to sing one of your songs. The degree
That's
of like, difficulty has gone up incredibly for anybody who wants to try to reproduce it. I just think he's remarkable. And Tristan Scroggins and Kimber Ludeker. You already mentioned Casey. Karina Logsdon is in High Fidelity, correct?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Yeah.
I've actually known her. I met Karina. She and I spent some time playing in a Reno and Smiley tribute band called Retro and Smiley that Buddy Griffin put together a few years ago. And she's a fabulous talent. Mm-hmm. And, well, all the people on the record were, you know, to me, if I can put on my old guy hat for a minute, you know, there is such a wealth of talent among younger musicians. You know, Justin obviously a great banjo playing and writing and singing and all that, but Casey Campbell and Karina is a fabulous fiddle player and singer as well. She sings harmony on a couple of things. Tristan, Molly Tuttle, you know, I got to meet Molly through Mark Simos, who teaches songwriting at Berklee School of Music, who said, hey, you need to get with this gal. She's moving to Nashville. And so we've done some writing together. And I one of the things that I thought, and I think we both sort of thought, was that this record was an opportunity to showcase. But again, yeah, in this very sort of natural way, because all of these folks are our friends.
It was really we made each choice really pointedly, but we weren't cherry picking. Like, it was just, we were wanting to make music with the people that we like making music with the most. And it just, and I think that you can really hear that in the record too, because it's not really overproduced. Basically recorded it, you know, in less than a handful of days, and kind of just let it happen like it was, you know, supposed to happen, and not really fret over it being flawless or you know, kind of manicured or sterile, and because it just lets everybody shine. Like, it really, you hear the difference in everybody's playing, you hear the difference in the two bands and the kind of nuances between them, but it still all sounds like one record. It's great.
I don't want to focus on one song and ignore another, but I do like a lot of the lyrics, and not surprisingly, you both are excellent songwriters, but we mentioned a little bit before I went on the air, in my notes I wrote down gorgeously sad, which is, this isn't how I wanted to come home. It's the only way I could describe it to myself as a reference. And there's a line in there about, I thought I'd bring my exile home. And I don't think we talked about that on the air, but there's so many lines. Like, let's use that for an example. In What I Miss the Most, the line I keep coming back to, as I guess is what the real song is about, is not being missed. When you're home, it's like, there's so many great lines. And I think that the listener needs to know that these are well-crafted stories within the song framework, and there's so many great lines that if you listen, you'll hear so many lines you've never heard before that I had to literally scribble things down as I'm listening, because there were little phrases little turns I'd never heard, and I think that the strength of the songwriting itself and the process that's shown, I think, is just really, it's worth taking notes on. Even to a casual listener, you need to write some of these phrases down so you can use them in your daily life.
Well, I think that is really a testament to kind of the perfect balance that, well, let's say the imperfectly perfect balance of John and my songwriting styles, because I will bring in, I'm very prone to writing really personal, really like open, emotive songs, and I bring those ideas to John, and he's able to help me execute them, but execute them in a way that, like, it really is true to the idea of the song, true to the feeling of the song, and can be heard and understood. And I think that's how we're able to accomplish, like, lines like that feel kind of maybe a little more towards, like, literary writing.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah, thank you. That's exactly
prosaic.
Right. That's right. Exactly,
like,
right.
They don't feel clunky or heavy, because they're there because they're supposed to be for the song. Because, like, John's really good at keeping that fidelity, like, for the song's sake.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, well, a bluegrass song, and Justin has heard me say this many times, and so some other people that I've written with, a bluegrass song, a chorus is typically four lines. You've got a couple of verses. There's four lines per verse. So a song, really, you're talking about writing 12 or maybe 16 lines, something like that, and that's it. And so every word and every phrase and every image, to me, I want them to really carry some weight and not be filler.
Not be filler. I was going to say, don't throw any of those opportunities away.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm very proud of these songs. I've written a lot of songs that I'm proud of, but this is a really good bunch, I have to say, in all modesty.
I think the biggest indicator of that is that John and I actually do listen to this music from time to time. We aren't, like, we aren't sick of it. We aren't, like, we'll go back to it. I'd like to go back to it to listen to what my amazing friends played on the record.
Oh,
but, like,
there's so many great players.
We just like the record. Like, it, I don't know. It just turned out so well. It feels like it turned out so well of its own accord, kind of because it was meant to be. It feels like I have enough distance from it to be able to be like, yeah, I'm really glad this happened.
I'll tell you another one. I'm just kind of looking glancing down at my notes. The tune "Doing What You Do," that to me, you know, because I think you ought to, if you start hearing about someone's teardrops on your pillows besides the song from the late 50s or 60s, you start thinking it's going a different direction. And really what the teardrops on the pillows are about is not the fact that the other person is leaving. It's kind of like what they're doing while they're present.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, Justin typically, most of the songs on the album started with ideas that Justin brought to our co-writing sessions.
Most.
That one is one of the rare ones that I brought the idea in, and I think I probably had a couple of lines of the chorus. But it's throughout these songs you'll find there's kind of there are a number of places where there's kind of an inversion
of a
typical bluegrass trope, you know, where and that's one way of being creative while staying within the bluegrass tradition, is to take some idea that has been done in other songs and give a new twist to it. And so
That's quintessentially bluegrass. Yeah,
it is. Well, and "Morning Prayers," by the way, is, you talk about quintessentially bluegrass theme. Who is that? Is that a personal song, or is it the song that you came out? That seems to me very touching to a person. Maybe not. I mean, but it seems to me that you have a father that has six kids, and he's praying in front of the kids' beds before the sun comes up. Where does that come from?
Well, that's real. That's autobiographical, pretty much. I mean, there are some fictitious touches in there, but that was my dad. That is my dad. He is a really just a faithful man, and really was. I really appreciate. But something that I really appreciate about him is his communication with us was never hampered because of some sort of like need to present as, you know, totally in control and masculine all the time. Like, he was really like communicated with us, and that was one of these kind of subtle, more subtle expressions of his love for us, was that he would pray for us before he woke us up in the morning or before he left for work. And so that was just turning literally something that, you know, happened to me in my life and being like, well, that's a bluegrass song, and bringing that to John, and John kind of helping me, you know, gain enough distance from it to write the song so that it can be something that connects with everyone, even though it is something that was so specific to.
Justin, I had a feeling that was you. And I don't know why. I just had a feeling that was you. Maybe because I've known John, and John never told me about his dad standing in front of their bed. So I had a feeling. I kind of knew where that answer was going to go.
Yes. Different faith traditions, too.
Exactly. that's true. All right. It's a gorgeous, kind of a slower song, and it is about a father and a kid's perspective of the father who every day gets up and goes to work, and he prays for the kids in case they have the difficulties that he's encountered in life, but he's still every day meeting them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and when Justin brought this idea to me, one of the things that really resonated and that we really kind of tried to put into the song, I think, was that, you know, and it kind of gets into, in I guess, the second or third verse, I forget which, but, you know, that the way the father in the song, and that's the way I'm going to put it, because is with songs, you know, and this is something that Justin and I have spent a lot of time talking about as we've written over the years. You know, is that a lot of times when you're writing a song, it may be motivated by a particular thing that happened to you, or some particular some event or situation that is really specific to you. But finding you have to be able to let go of the particular details if they don't make sense to be in the particular song, and kind of go for the overall feeling and vibe and point. And one of the things that was really interesting to me in this song that I thought was kind of the emotional crux of the song is that in his day-to-day relations, you know, the father is more, you know, there's a lot of, I think we used the word distant in there. You know, so the contrast between the sort of daily the daily life in which his father is a more distant figure, contrasted with the intimacy and the kind of secret intimacy of these morning prayers. That to me just really, you know, that fits a lot of different situations.
It does. It absolutely does.
Exactly, and that's how. And that's the importance and the beauty of having like such a great co-writing partner as John, is we're able to tease out those other kind of threads and storylines and kind of pieces of it, so we don't get too myopic. I love that song, and I love that song kind of gives me my little sort of like soaring Alison Krauss sort of moment on the record too,
yeah.
With that melody line.
Yeah.
Like it's. I love the kind of inherent drama of it, too.
That's a good description.
A lot of fun to sing.
That's a good description. We've talked about General Custer is the instrumental. We may have talked about that before, but that there's the only one instrumental tune on the album, correct, is General
yes.
Custer with a K.
Yes.
Okay. Nice.
It has a little bit of an interesting story. That's from a fellow Kentuckian, by the way. Brandon Godman wrote that and plays fiddle on it together with Molly Tuttle on guitar and Tristan Scroggins on mandolin and me and Justin. And that was I've known Brandon for a long time. He made me feel bad when we first met because he told me that he used to come see me when he was a kid.
So did I.
But he. Well, exactly. And in the state, at the Falmouth Wool Festival and all those great Northern Kentucky venues.
Yeah.
But Brandon was the guy who got he got me involved in the California Bluegrass Association's campaign to sponsor a float in the Bluegrass Pride Parade in San Francisco a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And he wrote that tune back then. In honor, it's named for Ted Custer, who is the chair of the Bay Area chapter of the California Bluegrass Association. And we were excited to get Brandon to be able. He was coming to Nashville for the SPGMA convention, the Society for the Preservation of Bluegrass Music in America, because he sells fiddles and bows and whatnot. And so he was able to be part of the album. And he called me up and he said, "Hey, the Bluegrass Pride folks are wanting to use my tune as the music bed for their sponsorship deck." So going out and getting sponsorships for Bluegrass Pride participation in Pride parades around the country. And so maybe we could just tack on this recording of my tune at the end of y'all's album session. Which is what we did. It was the last thing that we recorded.
Okay.
It was literally the last thing we recorded for the album because it was tacked on the end of the session. And we just liked it so much and thought that this was so emblematic in both in its traditional nature and in the context of its composition that it made perfect sense to put it on the album. So the band was great enough. Let's put it on there. And we've been very happy with it.
Good, it's a good tune. I'm always happy when Molly makes it into a song.
Oh man, me too.
Say what?
Gracious.
You know,
is a force. Gosh, just like being. So there were times like where I would be like we were in the studio, like
recording. If I don't marry Molly, I'll die. Yeah, go ahead.
Right, exactly. Like, we would be in the middle of a take, and she would be playing something that was so compelling, I would be distracted from what I was playing, just being like, wow, she's good. Wow, she's so pro. Like, goodness gracious, I'm so glad that she was able to be on this record.
It's a great...
Well, and it's a classic bluegrass name. So,
it is. It absolutely is. I'm saying it's a double whammy there.
It was one of the last songs that we wrote for the
album. Oh, was it really?
And Justin brought in the idea.
drawn
straight from life.
And as soon as
he said, here's my idea for the song, "If I Don't Marry Molly, I'll Die," I thought, that is a bluegrass song, and is a bluegrass song where all we need to do for the chorus, basically, is just repeat that over and over again.
Yeah.
So we did.
You could almost... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and then, again, that is part of what I enjoy so much about writing with Justin, is that he could bring that idea, I could say something like that, and he could, like, instantly get what it was that I had in mind. You know, like this is a three chord. No, it's four chords, but this is going to be a super traditional bluegrass song, because that whole idea,
sure,
if I don't marry Molly, I'll die, is like, you know, that it just fits in right with songs going back to.
Well, you could introduce it as something.
Yeah,
I was going to say, John, I was going to say, you could say this is an old Irish song, and everybody would think it was an old Irish song, because they sung a lot about Molly over there. I think it's great. Yeah. The whole album is a great, the tempos, and John, you said it best, that this is a bluegrass album. There's no question about it, and there's great tempos. There's a waltz or two tempo floating around, and great playing, and I love the words. And I think that shows from both of your, what you're describing to me is the method that you two feed off of each other and craft the song, and not just the music, which is equally important. But to me, I listen to words, and I think these words are, you made the reference, Justin, as far as the type of words that they are, literary in effect, and I do think a lot of these things are that, and it's just they're but you know what, they're not so hard that you have to work. In other words, you don't want the audience to have to Google things or research things.
Exactly.
But the words are right there, and they're pretty words, and they fit the song, and they're very pleasing. So I just think the whole thing works in that way.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's exactly like the kind of the balance that I think that we are pretty lucky to have achieved with this set of songs. It's like they say something. They're clearly saying something. They're not just being written to be written. And at the same time, they don't bog you down by being too overloaded with like a message if you listen down, just listen to it straight down, it's just a bluegrass record. It's
exactly.
just a bluegrass record. And if you listen to every single song and every single word, you realize there are a bunch of layers to this onion. Peel them back, maybe cry a little.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Listen, the guy that's got to live half of his life in a dream, I envy him because I don't sleep half of my life. I only sleep a few hours a night. And that's the song, half of the rest of my life is about somebody who's dreaming about, you know, someone he's not going to attain, I think is the way I read it. I'm thinking, that's half of your life is sleeping, if it's a sleep or a daytime, I don't know. But it's another twist again. Again, there's a lot of nice little twist, and we can finish discussing that, but it's a little bit, when you see the title, Half of the Rest of My Life, you think, what does that mean? And then you get into the fact that this guy is, the singer is he's going to live in a dream because he can't get the person that he wants.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, and again, this is there's something about the way that we work together that has been really very enjoyable and very productive in a very bluegrass sort of way. Justin comes in with all these great ideas. That was another one that was his idea. Mm-hmm. And as soon as he says these things, like I can see how the whole song is going to be laid out, you know. It's such a great idea, you know, that this guy's lost the one that he loves,
mm-hmm.
but he knows he can see him in dreams, so all he wants to do is sleep.
That's right, yeah.
You know, I mean, that's a very bluegrass idea.
It is. Yeah. Here's the thing, and the whole thing about the album, nobody dies. Except for if you want to see the one, the Way I Didn't Want to Come Home, or the song about this,
I
wanted to come home, mm-hmm. but it didn't happen in the song.
So nobody is
actively killed.
Nobody dies, but there is a body count.
Right. You're right. So we get so many stars for the body count, but nobody's actively killed in the process.
Yeah.
Of this song.
Okay. That's an important distinction.
It is. Listen, this has been a blast. Thanks so much for being available, John Weisberger, Justin Hiltner. Tell us how people can find this album.
Anywhere you stream your music, you can find this album. Just search for Watch It Burn or search for Justin Hiltner or John Weisberger. It'll show up anywhere you stream your music. If you want to purchase a physical copy, you can direct from Robust Records. That's at robustrecords.com.
Okay.
Otherwise, John, I know John brings the record with him when he's out on the road, and I do as well. So if it worst comes to worst, info@justinhiltner.com. I'll get you a record. I'll put it in your hand.
There you go.
Listen, guys, thanks so much for indulging me. When I fall in love with lyrics, I do, especially when I'm talking to songwriters, I kind of want to give the opportunity to let some of those things breathe with the audience, and I think that thanks so much for catching some of my drops, whether they were crucial to the song or not. I appreciate the fact that you ran with them.
No, thank you. Thank you for listening so closely. That really means a lot. I mean, because John and I are, like, we're songwriting nerds. We nerd over every single word, and so to have somebody, like, nerd out with us over it, it's like,
thank you.
Yes, this is exactly what we want to do. It's exactly what we do. We sit down across the table from each other, and we just talk like this for hours, and then we accidentally write a song every now and again.
Great. Well, it's great. John, it's nice to talk to you again. I see you fleeting now and running through Raleigh every once in a while, but I don't see you as much as I used to. And, you know, it's just, you just kind of, you become a will of a wisp. There he goes.
Always a pleasure, Steve. You know, Northern Kentucky is just about as close as I can think of a place that I call home, and so it's always good to talk to somebody that knows where Boone County
and all the chili parlors, and somebody who knows where all the chili parlors are and the recipes, the secret recipes. Justin, have you been up this way for the Cincinnati chili?
Yes, I'm actually an Ohio native.
Oh, are you?
Newark, Ohio.
Oh, about good.
30 miles east of Columbus.
Okay, all right.
So I'm well familiar with Cincinnati chili.
Good. Well, there we got to plug in. Thanks so much, guys. Justin Hilton or John Weisberger. I've enjoyed it, and carry on.
Thanks, Steve.
See you. All right, bye-bye.
Thanks, Steve.
Yep. Bye-bye.